Hi.
Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's fine. Everything is fine. Hey, everybody. Everything's fine.
Hey,
everything's fine. Relax. Everything is just fine.
Coming to you live from the 215. I am Kyle Pagan, as always, joined by my man, Mark Henry. Listen, we fucked up. Monday, you know, Mark's got a full-time job. He's got work to do and whatnot. Yesterday, I overslept. Couldn't be found. By the time we wanted to get on, Mark, once again, job just getting in the way. So, you know what? We missed Monday. We missed Tuesday. We apologize. But here we are, Wednesday, recapping the Jets. Got a little bit with Mike Sielski, who has a book, The Rise and Immortality of Kobe Bryant, coming out in early January. We get into that, about a little Kobe talk on the Eagles bye week. But before we get into today's podcast, we got to talk about Tap Room. And Tap Room is the premier beer delivery service in Philadelphia. If you use code FINE50, P-H-I-N-E 50, on a delivery of $100 or more on your beer, kombuchas, hard seltzers, everything else, you get $50 off. So be a hero. Put in code FINE50 at pa.taproom.com.
Is Tap Room just a Philly sponsor? Just a local?
Just Philly.
You got to love that.
It's a 4 for 4 guy.
You got to, is the Eganoff test?
It's within, it's within 20 miles of the city. It is. It's not all zip codes, though. So is it really a Philly? Is it a 5 for 5 guy? He doesn't work in Chester.
The Union, RIP.
RIP. RIP to the most, the best franchise in Philly right now.
Never mind.
So, say what you're going to say.
No, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, say what you're going to say.
I'm not going
to
do it.
People are sitting on the edge of their seat waiting to hear what you have to say about the Philadelphia Union. Now, everyone comes here for your Philly Union takes.
I will say that me and Kyle have a friend who may work for a radio station that I also work for, called Fox PHL The Gambler. His name is John Jansen. It is very funny that it just so happened that after last week, when we made fun of John after a very bad loss for tweeting a million times during the loss, that the Union playoff game happened at the same time as the Eagles game. So John conveniently got away without tweeting about the Eagles having a very good day. I don't think it would have pained him as much to tweet about it because it wasn't Jalen Hurts doing it. But I was surprised to see John not tweeting out about Gardner Minshew and Minshew Mania. But you know,
he would have stepped on Jalen Hurts' throat. We probably would have heard about how Gardner Minshew is like a Pro Bowl caliber quarterback. And I kind of actually don't blame Philly fans for like loving backup quarterback controversy. I was down there. If you haven't seen it yet, released the Jets Eagles tailgate video at MetLife. A lot of Minshew love. I would say a lot more, a good amount of Minshew hate as well. I just conveniently edited the video to be very pro Minshew because it was a very pro Minshew day. But Philly got exactly what it wanted for the next 14 days. It got some excitement. It got a QB controversy. And it's because the Eagles are 40-18 in the games that a backup quarterback has started since 2006. That's insane. And it's not like it's like, you know, you got your AJ Feelys, you got your Coy Detmers, but then you got like your Jeff Garcias, your Nick Foles, your Mike Vicks, your Mark Sanchez's, your Vince Youngs. Like, these are dudes who like didn't just have a cup of coffee in the NFL. These are all dudes that have like prominent moments. Nick Foles, 27-2, obviously the Super Bowl. Mike Vick.
Is this post Mike McMahon? Post Mike McMahon, 2005.
Yeah, well, Mike McMahon didn't play until 2006.
2006, not 2005. Yeah,
2006. Mike Vick obviously was like one of the best players in the NFL before all the dogfighting stuff, and then came back and finished second in the MVP voting. Sanchez went to the AFC Championship. Vince Young won the Rookie of the Year. Like, these are dudes who are like really good players. So I don't blame Philadelphia kind of for being like, maybe he's not a flash of the pan. Maybe he's still got it. When most of the time it's like, yeah, we know what he is. And then I think with Gardner Minshew now, we really know what he is. Like, it was awesome. 20 for 25, 242-2. It was a good, like, hey, not good, not great, or sorry, not great, not bad. get out, get home. It's great to know we have a cable backup if Jalen is injured in a big spot. I mean, I think it also goes to the Eagles now know what Nick Sirianni's offense looks like with a pocket passer. So if you want to evaluate Kenny Pickett or you want to evaluate going out and getting Russell Wilson, who's more of a proven pocket passer plus dual threat quarterback, you now know what it will look like in the offense. I think this will actually add a wrinkle to Nick Sirianni's offense when they look back at the tape. They'll add some scheme with Jalen Hurts. What was your takeaways from the Jets game, other than they are a putrid team?
Yeah, the Jets are not very good. But, I mean, this isn't shocking to me. This isn't news to me that Gardner Minshew came out and played a very good game, especially against the New York Jets. When they traded for Gardner Minshew, we said it on this podcast. I said it everywhere I could talk about football, that Gardner Minshew should have been traded for by about 29 other teams in the NFL. He is a top five backup no matter how you slice it. I think he's a fringe starter. I think that there's five-plus teams right now that'd be better with Gardner Minshew than their current starter.
Can you name him?
Top of my head, I'm Pittsburgh. I think Pittsburgh would be better with Minshew right now.
Jacksonville?
That's tough because he's a rookie. Houston for sure.
San Francisco?
No, not quite. Not quite. San Francisco. Cleveland. Cleveland.
Wow.
Yeah.
Minshew would be.
No, not quite. Okay. Detroit.
Okay. One more.
Denver.
You would take Denver. Baker. Okay. You would take. How about the Panthers?
Yeah, the Panthers.
All right. So we got six now.
Atlanta as well.
Oh wow, seven. I don't agree with your Cleveland over. I don't agree with your Baker over Minshew point, but whatever.
New Orleans also.
There you go. Nine.
So yeah, hey. Cleveland might be stretching it. You might be right on that. I just think Minshew seems like a better version of Baker. Like, he seems like he's that same kind of, you know, I feel like a lot of what you like about Baker is the, I was going to say cocky or arrogance, but those are negative traits. The galvanizing of the team in the locker room behind Baker. I think Minshew kind of has that similar type of vibe about him.
Well, that's why people, I feel like it's so easy to root for him. I mean, he's going nuts after the game. He sees a guy in his jersey and he's like, you would have think this guy just won a Super Bowl. You don't think he won against like the New York Jets are now like 3-10. And when he does have a good game and, you know, he's efficient and, you know, they blow him out. How can you not root for this guy going nuts?
Yeah. And to your point on the backup quarterback success we've had in Philadelphia, I think what that does more than anything is it shows that Jeffrey Lurie and Howie Roseman place an important premium on the backup quarterback position. They've only went into a year really one time without a real backup, and it ended up costing us. It was Josh McCown. We went to the playoffs, and it wasn't good enough to get us a win, or even in a game that if we had any sort of legitimate quarterback out there, we would have won that game because our defense.
Gardner Minshew
really
probably
well.
Wins that game.
100%. 100% Gardner Minshew wins that game. Gardner Minshew wins by at least a touchdown in that game, I think. But yeah, I think that proves, and this proves, I know that they only gave up, a sixth-round pick for Minshew, so it's not like they paid some insane premium, but I think that they repeatedly go after these backup quarterbacks, sometimes, you know, at fault. Sometimes you can blame them for doing that. Sometimes you can look at the Jalen Hurts draft pick and you can say that ruined Carson Wentz, and you can look at other situations. You can look at the whole Nick Foles situation and you can say that ruined Carson Wentz. So it's funny that, like, you can argue about which backup controversy really messed Carson Wentz up bad to the point that we had to get rid of him. But I think it shows that they are aware of how important the backup quarterback position is in 2021. As Charlie Casserly, the old man on the NFL Network, and he's like a draft guy and he was a GM in the past. The most important person in your organization is your quarterback. The second most important person in your organization is your backup quarterback. The third most important, or your backup quarterback. It's just like a gimmick.
It's a great
accent. Does, but yeah, it's. I feel like I'm pretty close. I'm pretty close to the Charlie Casserly accent there. But yeah, he's right though. The backup quarterback is so important, and I've always defended the Eagles spending resources at that position and going out to make sure that they have someone at that position. And I was upset when it was McCown a few years ago. So I thought that Minshew move was huge. I think it's one of the you just look at like what the cost it took. It's one of them. I mean, like smartest trades Howie's ever made. Even like no matter what happens, you know, no matter if he doesn't start another game, it was just like a no-brainer of a trade. I like I said, 29 teams in the league should have done it. I mean, Dallas had to throw Cooper Rush out there for a game. I know that they won the game, but Arizona had to throw Colt McCoy out there for a stretch. Like the Giants just threw the statue that's Mike Glennon out there last week, and he got destroyed. I don't know if he passed Geno Smith. I'm sure you'll get to that, but I think that Gardner Minshew, top 25 quarterback in the NFL, top 28 quarterback in the NFL, and Jalen's better. Jalen's a better overall player. He's got more upside. But I totally understand the people that are like, you know, I want to see Minshew. I don't like Jalen Hurts' play style. I'm not going to get into my thoughts on that. But I do understand the frustration because with Jalen, you're coming off of the worst game of his career. If you weren't coming off of the worst game of his career, it'd be a little bit of a different conversation. If you were coming off of the Denver Bronco game or the Detroit Lion game or, you know, one of those games where maybe he wasn't putting up huge throwing numbers, but we won the game and he looked good while doing it, I don't think the conversation would be the same. But Jalen played really bad against New York. Gardner played really good against the Jets. So I will say Jalen Hurts is a starter. He's still the guy. I'm assuming he's still your guy.
Oh,
he's still has the only chance on the roster at being the quarterback next season. And I will say, though, and Mike Kay wrote this better than anyone. I had kind of been saying it all weekend, and then I think he wrote the piece on Monday. Jalen Hurts is still the starter, but Gardner Minshew, he choked up on the leash. You know, your dog is running out, and he runs out in front of you. Gardner Minshew brought that leash back, brought the dog back. There's no leash. He's basically like he's holding it right up to the where you take it off now. Jalen Hurts can't play a bad half now. Like Jalen Hurts has to kind of be good every half he plays and every game he plays for the rest of the year. Or I think we're seeing Minshew.
Is that fair?
Maybe not. But there is a certain point where if Sirianni saw what he saw in Minshew, and Sirianni came out and said all the right stuff after and said how good he thought Hurts has been. But if he was impressed with what Minshew did, and if Jalen struggles again, I do think there's a part of Sirianni and there's a part of Howie and there's a part of Lurie that's going to think, well, I think we know Jalen's not the guy now. I think we know Jalen's not going to be the guy next year, and we still have a chance at the playoffs. Why not throw Gardner out there since we already saw that we might be a little bit better with him anyway, even if that's not fair because it is the Jets. I do think that his leash is gone, and I think that that's fine. I actually don't have too much of a problem with it. But hear me out. Two quarterback system, I'm down.
So when you need like a big drive, yeah, you know, say you have I guess you can't even really compare that because it's like I was going to say you have, you know, Jalen come in for runs and you have Gardner in for mostly passing plays or something stupid like that. Like, because the runs are effective when they're playing a rushing defense, they showed that against the Saints. So it's not like they can't run on the best defenses and whatnot. I mean, here's where I'll put a little bit of ice on your Minshew boner right now. The second half was not that impressive. Being down at the stadium, it was like Minshew mania for the first half. By the time the fourth quarter kicked in, people were so bored. I mean, I had a video of a shirtless guy in the stands. That was the most entertainment I saw in the whole fourth quarter. I mean, he had three drives that stalled, one that was elongated on a pretty ticky-tack pass interference call on Dallas Goedert. But there's no touchdowns, three field goals, right? That's all it was. Yeah, three field goals, and they win 33-18. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, Gardner Minshew lit the whole game on fire. It's a terrible Jets defense across the board, and I think there were third downs that Jalen would have converted with his legs that Minshew didn't convert in the second half.
Yeah, I didn't think Minshew played great in the second half. I thought that they were a little too conservative in the second half, though, in general, probably running the ball too much. So, you know, I think that they did what they had to do to win the game. But yeah, I think that there's, it's perfectly natural to want to throw, you know, cold water on the Minshew thing. I will say that his TD to interception ratio in the NFL, I believe, is now 39 to 11. I saw that out there. I don't even know if that's true. If that's true, that's pretty insane. But I just think that he was never as bad as people thought he was in Jacksonville. I always thought that he was a fringe guy there. I just thought he was the same. I literally thought he was exactly what I expected. Like, I thought that he was exactly what I expected, which would be an efficient guy who's not going to take a ton of chances down the field, who's going to dink and dunk up a storm, who's going to Chad Pennington his way to, you know, a win out there. And I think that that's what he does. I think he's just a pure moxie-driven quarterback who the team can get behind. Maybe that's something that is better as backup, better in spurts when you come out there and, you know, you only get to play one or two or three games a year. I will say that it seems like Dallas Goedert and Miles Sanders, and they were very happy after the game, and they were very happy that they were getting targeted in a normal passing offense in the NFL. Yeah, you're probably right that it says more about Sirianni than anything. I thought Sirianni called a perfect game. I thought that was, you know, the best game Sirianni's called of the year. He challenged the call that I wanted him to challenge. He went for it when I wanted him to go for it. He kicked field goals when I wanted him to kick field goals.
How do we not have chips and balls yet?
Oh my God. That was unbelievable. Chips and balls.
Get some chips and some balls.
But it's also like the subjectiveness of it is just crazy because they have that QB. It was a QB sneak or a run. Like a QB sneak. The Jets have that QB sneak, and the two refs run up, and they don't put up their hands for 10 seconds, and then they just see Zach Wilson's in the end zone, and it's a touchdown. And I'm like, how is that like what we're going with as a scientific process here? And then Gardner Minshew so clearly gets over the line. Like, I've never seen a QB sneak on that type of thing where it's like, oh, he got stopped on his first thing, let me go around. And it's been more obvious that he got a first down. They call it not a first down, and then we have to challenge it. We end up getting it overturned, and then that leads to the famous now, what Miles Sanders said, Gardner Minshew said. What did he say?
I know Gardner said that's why I wear shorts, because of these legs or something like that, but he said he was cracking jokes in the huddle. And that's the thing. That's another thing with, like, this whole Gardner stuff. Like, it's all fun and games, 1-0 against the Jets. Like, that would come back to bite him in the ass. If they can't, if in Philadelphia, yes, it would. If they went 1-2, 1-3 to end, it's like, oh, he's probably making jokes in the huddle, or you got, you know, Johnny Radio sports caller calling in being like, well, maybe he should, you know, focus more on the game than trying to be a comedian in the huddle. That would come back to bite him in the ass. This is the town that it would. I just, like, the way I look at Gardner Minshew is, it's like, you don't really drink, but like, everyone has that friend that when you get a little older, you know, you're either like married or maybe your job doesn't let you go out like you used to at night and get after it. But you always like have that little itch every couple of months where you're like, this is going to be a big drunk night. Now, some people are like, hey, this is going to be a big drunk night every week of the year. More power to you. But some of us have the friend that is probably single, probably doesn't really have many responsibilities, and you're like, I'm going to call up Mike or John or Jim, whatever. And you prepare yourself, and you know it's going to be a long night. You're gonna start at 4, go to a bar, go to another bar, go to a club, probably go to an after-hours club. You're going to find a diner, and you're not going to get home till 6 a.m. And you're going to wake up the next day, and you're going to have one of the worst hangovers you ever have, because either you're 28, 29, 32, whatever, and hangovers just hit differently at that point. This is what – and you tell yourself – I'm never doing that ever again. I got out of my system. It's a nice palate cleanser. And this is why I don't call Mike, Jim, John, Harry, whatever, because I always feel like shit after. And these are the kind of guys that, like, this is like every weekend for them. Like, this is what I think of kind of with like Gardner Minshew. He's just a nice palate cleanser, a memory of the old, the more reckless you. It's like not sustainable, but it's fun to mix it up a little bit from time to time. That's my Gardner Minshew.
I think it's sustainable. I think it's renewable energy.
I've seen what we saw in Gardner Minshew. Can I give you stats on his first start every season?
Oh, I know it's been unbelievable.
It's been unbelievable.
His
first start ever, he completed 88% of his passes. And in 2020, his first start, he completed 95% of his passes. Really good, when defenses don't prepare for him.
I don't care about the completion percentage thing. I care about the comp.
You're not a comp percentage guy.
Which helps your guy, Jalen, if anything, in this conversation.
It does.
It helps Jalen. But
I don't want to be the Jalen guy. I want to come at this with a...
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
But I am the Jalen guy.
I just think that Minshew's so efficient, and that's not from a completion percentage factor. You'll see when talking about football with me anytime, it's just like, I hate turnovers. So Jalen lost me a little bit 2 weeks ago with that Giants game. I know it was uncharacteristic, but those three picks, and it's tough to excuse, and it's tough to get out of my head. And that's kind of what's saying the whole leash thing. And that's what I'm saying. When if Jalen has a game like that again, where he's turning the ball over, that's what's going to get them to go to Minshew, because he's not going to. He's just not. He doesn't turn the ball over. He doesn't make mistakes. If he's going to make a mistake, it's going to be an incomplete pass. And that's a good thing about Minshew. And that's why I do think it's sustainable. And that's why I do think he would go help those teams like Cleveland and Pittsburgh and New Orleans that are on the fringe, I think, with a bad quarterback that's screwing them over. The joke, I think Miles said, like, how the fuck did you get that? And he said, because I'm so goddamn strong. And then that's why he wore the shorts, I think, so people could see the legs, he said. I also thought he was very nervous in the press conference, which I didn't expect from someone. Like, I expected him to just be like, I don't give a fuck type of guy. But it is different, though. He was playing in Jacksonville. I wonder if the media, like, this press conference probably looks a little different in Philly as opposed to Jacksonville. But they're not there yet, are they? They're still on Zoom, right? On the Eagles press conferences.
I think they're still on Zoom. It did feel like they were actually there.
It did.
Yeah.
Maybe there's,
I don't know,
some
if the Zoom
there
is getting better. I know that the writers travel, so I wouldn't be surprised if they do it in person. New York obviously has very strict COVID protocols, so I couldn't tell you, but it did sound like they were there.
It's pretty funny. I was obviously in New York this weekend, and the COVID protocols, it is funny to see, like, you go, not that I'm some, like, you know me, I'm a liberal snowflake, but you go from, like, Langhorne or Philly or wherever you're in Pennsylvania. I just doxed myself. But you go from these places where it's, like, mask optional to New York where it's, like, a mask everywhere. It is, like, it's an adjustment. But then you go from that, and I went to Penn Station on Sunday to go home, and I completely forgot that the Eagles were playing in New York. So I see these people walking by me in, like, Eagles stuff the first time in the morning. I was like, oh, I said to my girlfriend, I was like, I'm saying go birds. And then we're walking through Penn Station. I'm like, wait a second. If I go birds, everyone wearing Eagles gear. And she was like, where are the Eagles playing? And I was like, oh shit, they're playing in New York. I probably should have been at the game. Like, I probably should have came since I was there in New York anyway, on the train at 11 o'clock, like, heading toward, like, they stopped. Like, the train we were on coming home stopped at MetLife, which is,
yeah,
pretty funny.
I mean, MetLife, I actually enjoyed MetLife. I thought it was a really cool, just, you know, regular stadium. I mean, I think it looked a little bit like the Link and everything. The field is hilarious. It looks like the same field that, like, my 2-7 high school football team played on. Like, you could just see the turf. Like, you wonder why it's taken so many ankles, so many ACLs. It's terrible.
What was the transportation situation?
Transportation situation was a bus. Shout out to Green Legion. If you're thinking about taking any away trips, do it with the Green Legion. They do it very well. Breakfast, lunch, buses, beers.
That's the Fox PHL Gambler show, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They do it very well. Very, very, very organized, very efficient, like, just get in, get out. It was an easy one. Don't get me wrong. You know, there wasn't any, like, much to do, but no, it was great. It was a lot of fun. And his first football game I've been to probably, since the Super Bowl run, the Falcons, wow. The Falcons Eagles game, the divisional playoff.
My last football game was the Sam Bradford year when the Cardinals beat us like 87-3. That was my last football game. I refuse to go back. But I've never been to a road football game. And I've been to MetLife, but I've never been there for football. I've only been there for WrestleMania.
It was probably 2/3 full, honestly. I mean, the tailgate sucked.
Really?
Yeah, there was just not a lot of Jets fans tailgating. It's not, you know how like we tailgate in a parking lot? They have the same thing where they tailgate in a parking lot. But it feels like there's just like huge packs of Eagles fans. There's always like bands and shit or DJs and whatnot. None of that. Kind of just like sporadic groups thrown around this huge parking lot. The parking lot wasn't even filled. You know how wolves are like distant cousins of like dogs?
Yeah.
We're definitely distant cousins of Jets fans. Like, cool. You like interviewing them, the drunkenness, the blind loyalty to their team, their jerk offs like we are. Like, you ever remember when like in school you would see like the evolution of man going from like ape to like man?
I have a good comp here.
Yeah, that's like going up like that's like us, like our ancestors settling in Philadelphia and then just like walking up 95 to like East Rutherford and like becoming man. Like they went from like ape to man.
Do you watch Always Sunny?
Yeah.
So we're D right now. Like, okay. we're sweet D. We're the ones getting made fun of by everyone. We're the ones taking all the shit from the gang and from the guys. The Jets are cricket. That's the deal. So, like, we bring cricket around when we're feeling bad about ourselves so we can beat up on them and make fun of them. We're 12-0 against the Jets. D brings cricket around to distract the making fun of, like, you know, the gang making fun of her. They start making fun of cricket instead, and she jumps in, and they go, shut up, bird. So that's, like, we're D. The Jets are cricket.
We are eerily similar. That is.
But also, I saw some of the saddest jerseys of all time. Can we do like a top five sad Jets jerseys? Yes.
Mark, that's my theory that like you know how bad your organization is, your franchise has been by the level of jersey that you see, by the age of jersey. I mean, Mark, I've never seen so many Wayne Corbett jerseys in my life. You would have thought this guy was like Jerry Rice. Obviously, you're Curtis Martins, but he's a Hall of Famer, so let that one pass. Joe Klecko, former Temple legend. I thought it was Dan Klecko. It wasn't. It was his dad, Joe, from like 1970.
I saw LaDainian Tomlinson. He played like 2 years on the Jets. He was okay there. He was fine at the end of his career.
Le'Veon jerseys were there. A lot of Darrell Revis jerseys were there. You had your Zach Wilson jerseys and whatnot. But yeah, it was bad. Bad, bad, bad jersey.
I saw two. I saw one Jamal Adams jersey, and it's like he was never that good for you and then forced his way out. Yeah, and then I saw enough. I saw another Jamal Adams jerseys that had Blitz Boy taped over Adams. And I was like, you're not playing the Seahawks. Like if you were playing Seattle, like I would kind of get it. Like you're making fun of the guy, but you're just like, yeah, I bought a shitty jersey and I'm going to wear it to the game. And I'm going to make fun of a player that's not in the game.
Testaverde.
I'm fine with Testaverde. I saw Sanchez. I'm also fine with Sanchez.
Sanchez, cool with Pennington. I've never was a big Pennington guy, so I don't understand that. But
I'm fine with it.
I had Jets fans growing up, and they were like huge Pennington guys, so that makes sense. Huge Testaverde guys too. But yeah, I mean, you could just see like the old school like Champion or Reebok jerseys. They were just faded because they've been through the wash 70 different times. It's just hilarious to see like the state of the franchise by like how much you wear like back in the day jerseys.
Yeah, and it's a shame Namath is like. It's like almost too old. Like you'll see, I'm sure you did see some Namaths out there. Like I'm sure there is some.
All old guys though, right?
Yeah, yeah. Like if it was San Francisco, like Joe Montana, because he was like however many years later, 15 years later. Like if San Fran didn't have anything for the last 30 years, like people our age would still be wearing Joe Montana jerseys in the way that people like wear Cunningham jerseys, I feel like. Mm-hmm. But because Namath was like so long ago in like the 60s, like that's their relevant guy. Like that's
beautiful color.
Oh, for sure. For
those those Jets jerseys from back in the day, I saw a couple of people wearing them. I was like, that's a beautiful green.
Yeah. Close to
our it's embarrassing how much they go to Fireman Ed in the during the game. Like, embarrassing. Every kickoff, every third down, every big moment, they flash to a guy who quit on your team because of a butt fumble on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, the butt fumble is the most overrated moment in sports.
It just happens because it was on Thanksgiving. Moment. That's why people were so pissed off about it, because everybody was watching the game because they had nothing else to do.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. People remember that more. I think I've done this gimmick before, but people remember that more than the fact that they remember that he beat Bill Belichick in New England in the playoffs and that he went to back-to-back AFC championships. People just remember the butt fumble. Like, my little brother, who doesn't follow sports, is aware of what the butt fumble is. And that's just like an insane thing. He's 13.
It if the sixth man, this is the only one I can think of. I mean, I'm trying to, I guess you got, you know, the guy who dresses up, you got a couple guys that dress up for the Eagles. I don't really think of any Philly super fans, but like if the sixth man, like if we went through purgatory in the Sixers and the sixth man just decided to, you know, vacate his seats or up and leave or renounce his fandom, that motherfucker's not coming back. He's not getting the Jumbotron during big moments in Sixers game. That guy would be booed mercifully.
Yeah, the only, I'm trying to think of like the Phillies equivalent. There's no Phillies equivalent for being at the game, but I guess we would just say like Jack Fritz. I don't know. Like it would be like Jack Fritz quitting on the team right now. Like I can't see that happening. Imagine after that decade that we just went through, if like next year we came out like 40-50, like normal Phillies record or whatever you want to say, and Jack Fritz is like, "That's it. I've had enough. I'm done." And
guess what? If he came back, I'd boo him.
Yeah, exactly. No, he can't.
This is what you listen, it sucks. This is what you signed up for, okay? I mean, we went through it from like 12 to 16 in the Eagles organization with a couple good spread in there. We went through it a lot after the 2001 NBA Finals with the Sixers. Yeah. We're doing it right now with the Flyers. We're doing it right now with the Phillies. Like, it sucks. You signed up for this shit. You can't just renounce your fanhood and go to games and build the shtick up since 86 and just one day be like, you know what? I'm not Fireman Ed anymore. What do you do? Go to a couple fires and be like, hey, you know what? I'm not going in there. You know, fire doesn't take a day off. You can't just quit on your unit.
There's a bad joke that I could make that I won't.
I was thinking about a 9/11 joke. I did not make a 9/11 joke.
Shout out.
He wasn't even there for 9/11.
shout out Keith Pompey. That's all. I'll leave it at that.
You know what else is tough? Being a fan.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, Jack Fritz ran for us to get Bryce Harper. He ran for us to, you know, there was another big moment that I'm currently forgetting about because it's 8 a.m. But yeah, you can at Jack Fritz. You can clip this out. You can say if Jack Fritz leaves the Phillies faithful, we will not accept him back as the heart and soul of this fan base, like the Jets have seemingly accepted Fireman Ed Beck.
That's crazy. Yeah, that if you think of like the biggest Phillies fans, you think of like Jack Fritz, and like a guy who's paid to talk about sports, probably the biggest fan that you associate with the Phillies right now. This is crazy.
Do we need to do Flyer Corner?
Well, the Flyer Corner, I mean, it's an all around dookie fest.
So my first introduction into how bad the Flyers were doing the other night was watching SportsCenter, which now has hockey clips on it, which is pretty crazy. And they showed the Flyers coach saying, yeah, we're going to have to figure out ways to, we can't score, so we're going to have to figure out ways to win 1-0 and ways to win 2-1. I was like, that is not a great attitude from the head coach of a team. So once I saw that, I was like, this guy might be in some trouble knowing nothing about hockey. and he is now out. I saw a stat that said this is our I don't know if he was our sixth coach in 7 years or if
that's what it was.
Our next one is our sixth coach in 7 years or something like that. Six coaches in 7 years is wild. Are the Flyers more incompetent than the Phillies?
The Flyers are probably the most incompetent franchise in Philadelphia, but they will continually get a pass from their fans and from and this is just an outside perspective. I do think as buddies that are big Flyers fans, they just get a pass all the time. Like they could be pissed off, but they're like, but the Flyers, it's the Flyers, yo, the Flyers. It's like they'll continue to, if not sell out Flyers games, be at least 75-90% full. But man, like it's never good when a corporation runs your team. Like right now, Comcast is the sole owner because Ed Snyder died. It's never worked out. I'm pretty sure the Sixers used to be owned by Comcast. Mm-hmm. That never worked out.
Those idiots at Comcast sold them for like a cup of coffee to
$218 million. And it's just not good when the largest corporation in your city is the sole owner of your team. This Dave Scott guy is kind of like a puppet. And being a guy who used to work at Comcast, the Flyers are under Comcast Spectacore. No one gave a fuck about Comcast Spectacore. No one did. We were like, I think we were trying to sell it off when I was there. Like just try to sell it off. But yeah, I mean, they'll probably make some deal with someone in the city. It'll probably get better one day. It'll probably be undervalued, and then they'll go to become, you know, eight times their net worth that they do, because Comcast doesn't understand, you know, that side of the business at all, really.
Yeah, the Flyers are a joke. That's all I have to say. Gritty is the most relevant Flyer.
He really is. Like, he's the most, like, we had this conversation. Do more people know who Claude Giroux is, or do more people know who Gritty is? And it's no doubt Gritty.
Not even close.
Not even close. One more thing before we get to the NFC roundup. Can we say that the Carson Wentz trade was a rare win-win for both sides?
Yeah, and I think that's exactly what I said at the time. I think it's a win-win because if it went well for Indy, we were going to get a first-round pick. And if it didn't go well for Indy, then we were going to get a second-round pick, and it was going to prove that we were right to trade him. So it's if anything, I guess it's more in the middle because it's like, I guess the question of were we right to give up on him is still looming. Mm-hmm. I think it was correct, and we think it was correct. And you look at the contract stuff, and it's hard not to argue, but it's a tough situation, but I would say it's way closer to a win-win than anything else.
If you look at his stats from this year, and I didn't take last year because last year was just an anomaly, from 2019 to this year, they're not much mm-hmm. different. They're not. They're better, but they're not like, you know, he's not averaging, you know, 3-4 more yards per attempt. He's actually averaging less passing yards a game with a better O-line. Probably similar O-line to 2019 and definitely better O-line than 2020. I would say a almost or equal coach, better wide receivers, the best running back in the game right now this season. It's not much different. I mean, I think if he's still here, the Eagles are probably 8-5, maybe 9-4, beating two out of the three of the Raiders, Giants, and 49ers, and they're probably fighting for the division if he's still here.
Wait, really?
What?
You think we're 8-4 or 8-5 or 9-4 with Carson?
Yeah,
Wentz?
I think he wins two of the three out of Raiders, Giants, and 49ers.
I don't.
I think. You think he loses all three of them?
I think it'd be like the same.
Really? You really think we would be, what are we, 6-7 right now?
Maybe we'd be 7-6. I think Hurts and Wentz have been playing at a similar level this year.
I would just kind of look at his like veteran presence. I've been there before kind of game. Maybe they would have found out that they're a run team quicker. Or maybe not. I think he would be probably 8-5 at least if he was here right now.
I'm shocked to hear that. That shocked me.
That 49ers game, I think, is going to be a bad taste in our mouth when we look on the season. And that Giants game is definitely going to be a terrible taste in our mouth. The Raiders game, it's, I think that maybe you just got a very passionate team in a time where you didn't know your identity in Vegas.
I agree with that. And you know what? They probably do win the Giants game with just because of
he owns the Giants.
Not just because of Wentz, just like if it was anyone, we probably would have won that Giants game. Jalen played terrible. And then obviously Rager had his own shit at the end. But yeah, I guess I probably think that there's some game in there at some point that we may not have won if we had Wentz. I'd have to look into it.
New Orleans.
Yeah, Hurts owns the Saints.
Hurts owns the Saints.
But I don't know. I'd have to think about it. I'd really have to think about it. Carson Wentz is the most difficult evaluation in the NFL, in my opinion. It's just like so hard for me to determine what my opinion is on a week-to-week basis with him. I think they make the playoffs. I do think they make the playoffs. And it does suck that we keep winning, the Colts keep winning, and the Dolphins keep winning. We're going to end up with like the 2021 and 22 picks.
I know. It does. Let's get into NFC East. Roundup, Washington football team versus the Raiders. Back-to-back 17-15 wins by the Washington football team. Is that a duplagami? Is that a sequentogami? Like, what do we call that?
I don't know, but they did it twice in 6 days.
Yeah,
they did it Monday night and then Sunday. It's unbelievable. That's just outrageous stuff.
I don't know if you're a Redditor by any chance, but the Heine King, I'm officially scared of the Heine King. He beat the coin. Have you been hearing about the coin?
Yeah, yeah.
So anyone that doesn't know, this random Raiders fan before the season just flipped a coin for every game, and he's been right for the last 13 weeks, and it had them going 10-7. This is the first time the coin lost, and it was the Heine King who defeated the greatest force of nature right now. So now I'm a little worried about the Heineken going into next week when we play him.
Yeah, the Heineken is, I mean, how could you not be nervous about the Heineken? We're absolutely losing to them in Washington, but I think that we beat them in Philadelphia. I think that we're destined to split with them. But yeah, Washington's scary. They have a huge game coming up this week against Dallas. That is going to be a huge game. We actually kind of have to root for the Cowboys probably so that Washington loses that game. I think that's a 50-50 toss-up game. And for anyone like subjective or objective, I should say, on the outside watching that game, that's going to be a fun game, in my opinion. I think Dallas-Washington's going to come down to the wire. Like, I think that's going to be like a game-winning touchdown or a field goal on either end. And that's going to be a game I definitely am excited to watch.
So we're good against like mediocre quarterbacks. Like, where are we putting Heineke?
Top five, top seven,
top five in the last 4 weeks.
No, seriously. I think Heineke's on that Hurts Wentz level right now that I was just talking about. I'm not even joking either. That's the sad part. But I trust Heineke so much. It's crazy. The guy just like leads these 15-minute drives down the field. These guys, like, at the end of the game, no one thought that Heineke wasn't going to take them down the field to get a field goal. We were rooting for the Raiders for playoff purposes. I'm sure the Eagles fans out there were with me there, rooting for the Raiders. And just slowly but surely, Heineke gets down the field because that's what he does. He wins football games.
Did you hear about Dabo?
No.
Dabo was at the game on the sidelines.
Washington?
Come on. It's the Las Vegas Raiders. They don't play away games.
Oh, he was at the Vegas. He was in Vegas.
Dabo was in Vegas.
Oh, you're saying to be the Raiders coach.
Visiting CJ Spiller and hanging out with Hunter Renfrow. And supposedly CJ Spiller is getting inducted into the College Football Hall of Fame. For some reason, it's in Vegas when the College Football Hall of Fame is in Atlanta. I don't understand the logistics there. Maybe he just was like, hey, I live out there now. Supposedly, Dabo FaceTimes Derek Carr an alarmingly amount.
Yeah, they seem like they would get along.
Like an alarming amount, supposedly they FaceTime. Coaching carousel, Brent Venables is gone. Dabo had kind of a down year. Dipping his toe in the NFL waters?
That would shock me. That would shock me. Yeah, I that would genuinely shock me. He's a college guy. He did say once they started paying players, that's when he wouldn't be coaching college football anymore. Mm-hmm. It did seem like he kind of audibled from that stance a little bit. But who knows? I always thought that he was the guy that they would replace Saban with at Bama. I always thought that they'd try to get Dabo to go to Bama. I'm surprised Texas didn't make a run at Dabo last year, but also Dabo probably thought in his head that he had DJ Uiagalelei coming in to continue the run from Trevor Lawrence to keep going undefeated. So he probably didn't want to leave while the going was hot. Maybe he thinks Clemson kind of hit its peak. I'll tell you what, timing-wise, I understand wanting to leave Clemson right now. I understand wanting to get out of there and kind of while it's still fresh that you created a monster there to go to the college football playoff repeatedly. I think he should leave to stay in college. I think he should go to a college job. But, hey, that's interesting. It's something I wouldn't have thought about until you brought it up.
He's definitely not an NFL coach. Like, let's just bury that right there. Like, he's just not a player's coach. He's a guy who needs to hold a scholarship over a player's head.
Agreed 100%. I was hoping Notre Dame would hit him up, but it doesn't seem like that was the case.
Anything else on the Washington football team and the Raiders?
No.
All right. Dolphins, Giants, just an abysmal game. Dolphins 20, Giants 9. If you're a fan of the 2013 NFL draft, or if you're a Jets fan right now, The only story you have to be worried about right now, since your team is 3-10, is the Geno Smith versus Mike Glennon passing yard supremacy competition. And right now, we've got a barn burner and a lot of implications are going on right now. So currently, Geno Smith obviously had his time in the spotlight while Russell Wilson was hurt. Mike Glennon, also now that Daniel Jones is probably missing the rest of the year with a neck injury, we're looking at maybe the last-ditch effort from Mike Glennon to overpass Geno Smith for most passing yards into 2013 NFL draft. But Mike Glennon is now in concussion protocol, and Jake Fromm is probably going next week, which throws another wrench in the Mike Glennon versus Geno Smith QB competition. It's the most interesting thing in sports right now.
I think the most interesting thing in sports is Jake Fromm's inability to come up with a nickname for himself. He did the Jake Fromm State Fromm. That's his Twitter handle. I don't know if you know that.
It should just be Jake Fromm State Farm.
Exactly.
Like, we don't have to overcomplicate things for brands anymore, people. Just, like, know where your bread is buttered.
That's like Clowntonio Brown. It's Antonio Clown. Like, yeah.
I like that better.
It's unbelievable that Jake Fromm thought that the way to go was Jake Fromm State Farm when he had Jake Fromm State Farm sitting right there in front of him. That type of, you know, inability to be aware of your surroundings and inability to be aware, I don't know. It's hard to have any sort of confidence that he can have success in the NFL as a quarterback.
Well, what do you think about the whole QB competition, this whole 2013? Like, if you're a Jets fan right now, like, Tampa Bay, obviously you got Tom Brady, you got nothing to worry about. But, like, if you're a Jets fan, like, you're looking at this, you're like, we drafted the best quarterback in the 2013 NFL draft. So, like, I don't know what you want us to do. Maybe we should bring back Mike Tannenbaum.
All I'm saying is, you know, the Carolina Panthers, the quarterback situation's rough right now. I do believe Matt Barkley's there. I think Matt Barkley is about 430 yards behind or something like that. Or maybe something less.
No, he's like 4,000.
I meant 4,030 yards behind. So Matt Barkley, when he earns the job this year in Carolina and goes down a run on the to end this year, 5-0, he's going to get brought back next year as a starter.
It's never good when the seventh leading passer in your draft is a punter with 27 career yards.
That's funny.
Whoever Sam Martin is from Detroit, or if he is still in Detroit, he's still active. So, yeah, so just pay attention to the best QB competition right now going. Mark, the Sixers, I don't know what to make of the Sixers right now. Because I'm a big, you know, if the Sixers are like 12-4, be like, yeah, let's go. Ain't no stopping us now. We're on the loose. But now that they're kind of like coming through COVID protocols, they had to go to overtime with the Charlotte Hornets off of back-to-back. I'm kind of like, hey, you know, everyone knows basketball season doesn't start till Christmas. So I can't really feel the juice right now. I don't really get the juice on the Sixers. I enjoy them, watching them. Loved watching Embiid just put the team on his back and just take every shot in overtime the other day. But I can't get the juice right now with the Sixers.
I think that that's how a lot of people in the city feel right now. And I don't know if that's just like with football season in full swing, college football last weekend, no one was going to watch the Sixers on Saturday night. I'm sure even you were probably watching college football Saturday instead of the Sixers, right?
Yep.
So, yeah, I think that that's probably a lot of people. And then obviously you have your flyer bunch out there and you have the people paying attention to other stuff going on. I think that's how college basketball, even you were watching Temple last night. If the Sixers were on last night, I bet you would watch Temple over them too, right?
Temple would be on TV too.
Yeah.
On mute.
Okay.
I don't know who would be on mute.
So I think a lot of people feel that way about the Sixers right now. And I think the whole COVID stretch really did hurt the enthusiasm of the fan base right now. I think that the West Coast trip, happening right after that, where every game was at 10 o'clock and our main players weren't even playing, kind of killed off any excitement of the season. I will say that I'm getting excited just watching Joel get excited. The fact that the last two games he celebrated the wins like he won the NBA Finals and they were like the best wins of his career makes me happy to see him happy. Obviously, there's been times in the past where he comes out when he's struggling. I'm not playing, having fun, you know. And he starts complaining about not having fun and stuff like that. And I always feel bad when you hear that because when you're as good as Joel Embiid is at basketball, he should be having fun out there. And when you're as good of a guy as Joel Embiid is out there, you know, we'll do the whole your guy thing for Jalen Hurts. Joel Embiid's my guy more than like any guy has ever been anyone's guy in life. So I just seeing him happy out there is bringing joy into my Sixers season. And I will say that like his press conference where he just kind of threw a lot of shade at one particular person without throwing shade at a particular person was lovely. He was talking about how likable the entire team is and how in the past he hasn't wanted to hang out with every one of his teammates off the floor. And now he is bonding with every one of his teammates. And then he ended up couching it. And
who do you think that's about?
I think it might be about – he gave it away because at one point in it, he goes, everyone here is so likable. I feel like that
– Read the quote.
So the Rich Hoffman quote, after what I just kind of said, he then said, there wasn't anybody that was not likable in the past, but it makes it easier when you have guys like that that care about winning. When we lose, you look at the Boston game, we were all pissed off. We all played so bad, and we were still right there. I think that he was saying by – when he said everyone here is so likable, I think that that is a little bit of a shot at the person who is not there, who is under contract. And I think that that's where the rest of the Sixers conversation has to go because all these reports are coming out that Damian Lillard wants to play with Ben Simmons. So the Trailblazers, Ben Simmons rumors are picking up steam for the fifth time in the past couple of months. I think this is – I've come on many times saying that it seems like they're picking up steam. But it seems like that's happening more than ever right now. Apparently Dame wanted Ben traded for CJ McCollum and 4 first round picks. That was apparently a report from a couple of weeks ago. CJ McCollum now has a collapsed right lung, which sounds incredibly painful. What does that entail? Collapsed right lung.
I think when your lung collapse on the right side of your body.
Well, that's thanks for being a dick about it. But I don't know. Like,
I don't know. What am I, a fucking doctor?
I don't. That sounds like a 3-year injury to me. Sounds like CJ's not playing basketball until 2025. If I got a collapsed right lung, I wouldn't get on a floor for years.
No shot and go to Denver.
Oh, shit. I didn't even think about that. Yeah. He's had some great moments in Denver, too. But yeah, there's. Oh my God. When I heard that, I freaked out. I was like, oh my God, is CJ McCollum's career over? Like,
I think collapse is better than punctured though. So let's look at the bright side.
Tony Romo had a punctured lung. I think he played too. So I guess it's not that crazy, but, lung, punctured lung, whatever. So
Tyron Taylor.
That's true too. But CJ McCollum, Anthony Simons, couple first round picks. For Ben Simmons, it seems like that is probably the conversation right now.
Where's the ceiling for that team, that Sixers team, if that goes through?
The championship, winning the championship.
Really?
Yeah. I think that there is a lot of concerns about bringing CJ in. Everyone's saying, oh, can you play CJ and Maxey defensively together? Can you play CJ and Seth defensively together? People currently saying, can you play Maxey and Seth defensively together? And my answer to that would be that Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum have been the most untenable defensive combination of guards in the history of the NBA. They've won between 45 and 55 games every single regular season. That's without Joel Embiid. So I think you add what CJ McCollum brings to an offense to what already is a top 3 offense in the NBA with a top 5 player in the NBA in Joel Embiid, what it gives you is someone at the end of games. And CJ McCollum is the exact type of guy that you want having the ball in his hands at the end of games. He makes those shots. He has a lot of different options on how he can get those shots off. He can get to the rim. He can shoot a mid-ranger. He can shoot threes. CJ McCollum's a incredibly diverse offensive player who I think we will see in his own situation. I know that Joel is the guy, but without Damian Lillard, I think you'll see him even grow as a scorer and grow as a guard, that is a combo guard. I really think it's a perfect fit. I always have thought it was a perfect fit. I plug in a 3-point shooter who's taken 11 threes a game into this offense, and I think that makes for some exciting stuff. And what it really does is it allows you to, in my opinion, what I would do is I would start CJ at the one. or Seth at the one, whatever. Let them combo guard. I would start CJ, Seth, Matisse, Tobias, and Joel, and I would move Maxi to the bench unit for now. Man, he can start if they want to, if they really want to, but they should be staggering as many minutes as possible to have Maxi off the floor when Joel is off the floor, because Maxi has been so incredible with Joel off the floor that you kind of have to have him running the unit out there, and I think that bringing McCollum in would really allow for that.
You convinced me, Mark. I'm all in on the CJ train right now.
Hell yeah.
Anthony Simons, wasn't he an interesting player because he like kind of reclassified but mm-hmm. never went to college, and he's actually the quote unquote last high school player to ever be drafted because he never really went to college or never went overseas. He just kind of like some weird some weird loophole that he like was drafted out of high school.
Yeah, he was. He was drafted out of high school. He was someone who I always struggle in the NBA draft evaluating foreign guys and then evaluating these high school guys, because it's so hard to, once you see guys in college putting up college numbers, you can kind of compare them to each other and you can compare them to their competition. But once it's overseas, once it's high school, it's like, fuck, I'm without a paddle here. And that was kind of where I was at on Anthony Simons. But after he was drafted for 2 years, Portland basically told everyone that they had Damian Lillard 2.0, which they didn't, obviously. But he has turned himself into a nice player, and he's turned himself into a backup guard.
21 too, right?
Yeah, he's got to be really young.
21, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's an interesting player. He's definitely someone that I'd be interested in them bringing in. He'd be a great backup for this team.
I think Monday's game against the Hornets, I think that showed you how much Joel Embiid is going to need another scorer. When, you know, he love the guy putting the team on his back, can't do that, you know, in the playoffs every time when defenses are locking down and you're not playing the Charlotte Hornets. Another scorer like CJ, like you just described. You convinced me. I'm all in. CJ or bust.
Yeah, and Simons, by the
and
way.
And four first rounders. Whew.
Seriously. And Simons, by the way, just a quick aside, 38% from three this year on 5.4 attempts in only 23 minutes, and 43% from three last year in 4.4 attempts on only 17.3 minutes. So this guy per 36 is taking just an insane amount of threes, 9.2 last year, 8.4 this year. This guy is he's unconscious from three.
Do you have a cross-racial comp for the people?
For Anthony Simons?
Yeah. Better Furkan?
No, he's a point guard.
Sabonis?
No. He's like a 6-foot point guard. I don't know.
TJ McCollum?
I'll say, remember when campaign was going off for the Suns last year?
That's a black guy.
Oh, I'm not doing cross racial every time. Only when it applies. But
okay.
When campaign went off in the playoffs last year, that's like the good version of campaign from the playoffs last year is like, I have that in my head for like Anthony Simons having that run in the playoffs. It's like, oh, Anthony Simons. Like, I think they could do like a very similar, you know, like 14 points per game, efficient from three.
I'm glad you don't see color. All right. Now let's get into Mike Sielski and talk about The Rise, Kobe Bryant, and The Pursuit of Immortality coming out January 11th. Mark, what was your favorite part of the interview?
My favorite part was when I excused myself from the Kobe fellatio session that happened. Now, I just didn't want to come off like a horrible person talking about how, you know, a guy that's celebrated now universally because of what happened, the tragedy that happened. Maybe wasn't that great of a guy. Maybe wasn't as good at basketball as people thought. Maybe wasn't as influential as people thought. But, you know, whatever. It's fine.
That's how you tee up an interview, baby. Let's get to Mike Sielski. All right. We got a good one today. It's Eagles bye week. So let's talk a little bit stuff. Let's talk some different things. We have Mike Sielski, reporter from The Inquirer. He is writing a book coming out on January 11th, The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality. Mike, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing today?
I'm great, Kyle. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, how's the book tour? Are we doing cities? We doing just more virtual interviews?
Well, I mean, it's not out till January 11th. So right now I'm doing the virtual interviews that I that I can. We've got a podcast that kind of complements the book. The podcast is called I Am Kobe. That's out now. We're five episodes into that with, you know, set 5 to 7 more to come. So doing, you know, publicity here and there, but come January, things will ramp up.
What's different about the podcast that you might not see in the book? Is it stories that go a little deeper, or you have more guests that know Kobe? Like,
well, the book's deeper. And the podcast is, it's a little, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a little bit more of like an oblique way to come at Kobe, in that one of my primary sources for both the book and the podcast was a guy named Jeremy Treatman, who, if your listeners are familiar at all with Philadelphia area basketball, he's been kind of a mover and shaker in that role for a long time. He was an assistant coach and a confidant of Kobe's when Kobe was at Lower Merion. And back in the mid to late 1990s, they tried to collaborate on a book and it didn't come off. But Jeremy did a series of interviews with Kobe, some of which he transcribed. So he gave me the transcripts when I approached him about the idea of doing this book. And then about a year ago, Jeremy actually found the micro cassettes of these interviews. He had not heard them in 25 years. No one else had ever heard them. He gave them to me. I was able to listen to them, weave them into the book, and then take the audio of Kobe talking when he's 17, 18, 19 years old and turn it into this podcast. So the podcast is kind of the story through Jeremy of Kobe at that time in his life. The book is a little more of a wider view. The podcast is much more kind of Kobe and Jeremy in a way.
What was he kind of like in the younger days? Was he, you know, we remember him as a killer, just a kid who just had so much confidence, a guy who had so much confidence, a man who became, you know, one of the most confident players in the NBA. What was he like when he was, you know, 17, 18 years old, when you're listening back to these tapes?
It's scary in a way to hear how confident he was even then. I mean, you know, when he was 14 years old, he was telling people, I'm going to make the jump to the NBA. And people would laugh at him, his friends and peers, most of them would. And it's striking to hear that. You know, you're right about how we perceived him and how he was as an NBA player. But I think people forget just how driven he was. And it's startling to kind of hear a 17-year-old kid speak this way. That he is that determined, that committed to being great, and that he's willing to do whatever it takes to be great, whether it's, you know, working harder than everybody else, sacrificing social relationships, whatever it took to be the greatest basketball player in the world, Kobe Bryant was willing to do it. And it's almost, you know, you hear him talk about his teammates or his first coach with the Lakers, Del Harris, and you're taken aback, like, the kid's only 18 years old and he's saying this. It's, but you know, that's the Kobe we came to know and admire or be fascinated by over time. And you really do get a sense of how early on in his life, that persona and that personality were being formed.
So why Kobe? Why tell a story about, from what I've read from the articles you sent me over, it seems like it's going to highlight mostly on his rise in his younger years and how he became the guy he was today. I'm sure you get into the posthumous stuff and whatnot, but why write a book about Kobe?
Well, after Kobe died, I did some writing about him for the Inquirer. I had known Jeremy, as I mentioned, for a long time. I knew Greg Downer, the high school coach at Lower Merion and a friend of Kobe's. I'd known Greg pretty well. And it occurred to me that the story of Kobe's early life, the one that we in Philadelphia and around Philadelphia know pretty well, Lower Merion, jumping to the NBA, state championship, all that kind of stuff. Number one, there was this inherent drama to it. And number two, people outside of the Philadelphia area did not know that story as well as we did. So I thought there was really a bigger, broader audience to be able to tell that story and people who would be receptive to it. And then the other thing was, I liked Kobe's so fascinating and so interesting and multidimensional. I liked the idea of his origin story. I decided I kind of wanted to do Batman Begins for the Black Mamba. Like that was the hook for the book was, you know, how did Kobe Bryant become Kobe Bryant? Well, you can see it all in his early life, right up till the moment that he enters the NBA. And you're right, the book stops there. You get a little bit of his first year with the Lakers, but that's it. It's all early life, a little bit of the posthumous stuff right after he died. That's kind of where the book begins. The first chapter is about the aftermath of his death, purely from the Lower Merion perspective of things. And then we kind of fade back to his birth and take that all the way through till he enters the NBA.
Who says Liam Neeson?
That's a really good question. Probably, I think you could say Chester High School. If you know anything about
The Chester train.
Yeah, Philadelphia area high school basketball. Lower Merion was not a great program when Kobe got there. And they were 4-20 his freshman year, which seems kind of impossible. How do you lose 20 of 24 games with Kobe Bryant on your team? But they did. But by the time Kobe was a junior, they were competing for the district championship, and they make the district final, and Chester just wallops them. Mm-hmm. And Chester, they're not the bad guy in this by any stretch of the imagination, but they are the foil for Kobe and Lower Merion. They are the opposite of Lower Merion in terms of their basketball history, in terms of their socioeconomic demographics, all of those things. And so when Kobe comes back as a senior and Lower Merion is going to challenge for the district and state championships, it's Chester who's standing in their way. And anybody who covered those games back then or is familiar with that knows what battles were. They were incredibly, you know, incredible games, two incredible teams going toe to toe. I guess Chester was his Ra's al Ghul, I guess you could say.
That's awesome. Yeah. I grew up watching Matt Carroll, Pat Carroll, and the Happer Horsham days play Chester, Jameer Nelson, some of the greatest battles I've ever seen.
I know. Yeah. I covered the Carrolls back when they were at Happer Horsham. It was a great time.
Yeah. Amazing. The Chester train, I'm telling you. Greatest cheerleading section I've ever seen.
Absolutely.
In my life.
Yeah, it was terrific.
So who are these interviews kind of with? Obviously, people that mostly affected him in his younger days. Is there any insight there? Maybe coaches, teachers, pupils from back in the day?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to talk to people as much as I could, people who either hadn't been heard from with respect to Kobe's story at all, or people who knew a lot and a lot of that hadn't been drawn out. Like, for instance, I was really curious about Greg Downer himself. He gets quoted all the time about Kobe because he coached him in high school. But I didn't know much about Greg's background. Like, how did he become a high school coach? And why is it that he was equipped to be able to extract the very best from Kobe when Kobe was at Lower Merion? What was it about Greg that made Kobe want to stay at Lower Merion when he could have gone to any number of private schools in the Philadelphia area, you know, and gotten a scholarship and gone and played for a big basketball powerhouse? Why did he decide to stay and play for his local school? I talked to Kobe's favorite teacher at Lower Merion, his English teacher, Jeannie Mastriano. I talked to his guidance counselor. I tracked down the only middle school coach he had in America, a guy named Dr. George Smith, who was the eighth grade boys basketball coach at Bala Cynwyd Middle School and had never been interviewed about Kobe before, presumably because his name was George Smith and nobody could find him, you know, because it's too hard to figure out which George Smith to talk to. I got people like that. Kobe was in the Black Student Union at Lower Merion. I didn't know that until I began the research. So I tracked down members of that organization and female friends of his who could lend a different perspective on Kobe's kind of grappling with his identity as a Black kid in a posh suburban school district who kind of falls out of the sky. He'd been living in Italy for 8 years and didn't know much about American culture. And here he is in eighth grade out of nowhere. And he hasn't had the same upbringing as the Black kids in the Lower Merion school district. He hasn't had the same upbringing as the white kids. So where does he fit in? Those were the stories I wanted to tell. And since I only had a year to do the research and write the book, I kind of sacrificed trying to track down some of the bigger names, people who had weighed in on Kobe a lot, for the sake of finding these other voices so I could tell a fuller, more complete story of his life.
Can you talk to people? Sometimes I think people don't understand kind of what goes into writing a book. It's obviously these words are printed on these pages and it doesn't ever, you don't really ever see, you know, kind of like what goes in behind the scenes. I mean, you're tracking down, I'm sure, over hundreds of people that had probably, you know, lived in Lower Merion, could be as far as Florida, could be as far as California. You don't know where they're at. And then also, I mean, you're doing it in the middle of a pandemic and COVID and whatnot. So can you walk people a little bit through like what you went through to kind of put this book together?
Sure. Well, in some ways, and I hate to say this because of everything that everybody's been through over the last 18 to 20 months, but in some ways, the pandemic made it easier to do the book because just about anybody I called was home to answer the phone. So anyone I wanted to reach out to, I generally got, and I couldn't travel. I wanted to go to Italy to do research. I couldn't. I wanted to go to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, because Kobe and Lower Merion played a big tournament there his senior year. That was really, it's a turning point in his senior season. I couldn't go because of the pandemic. So I ended up making all these phone calls and trying to talk to people in person when I could. I would meet people out for lunch. I would go to Greg Downer's house once a week, and we'd sit on his back deck and talk for hours. I would meet Jeremy Treatment in person. I meet his ex-teammates, call them up. I spent a lot of time at the Lower Merion Historical Society, where they have saved old copies of newspapers, and in particular, old copies of the Lower Merion High School student newspaper, which was really great to kind of fill in gaps in terms of what was really going on at the school at that time. What were the things that students were talking about? What were the topics that were big on everyone's minds? What things was Kobe saying to the student reporters that he wasn't saying to the reporters from the Philadelphia Inquirer and Daily News and the Mainline Times and things like that? So you do all that. You go through newspapers.com and archival material, and just it's research, kind of combing through, reading books about the Lakers and Philadelphia basketball and all that kind of stuff. I spent a ton of money on Amazon ordering all kinds of research material, but you just comb through that and look for nuggets. Early in the book, I get a lot into Joe Bryant's life, okay, because I think in order to know Kobe's story, you've got to know Joe's. So I spent a day at Temple at their library combing through old copies of the Philadelphia Bulletin to learn more about Joe. So there was a lot of it. And then you would sit down and just write every day. You have to write every single day if you're doing a book. You can't stop. You can't procrastinate because the job will become too overwhelming.
Have you talked to anybody in the family? I know sometimes posthumously people are like a little, I don't really want these books to be written, or I don't want these videos to be played. I know there's like, supposedly there's a last dance being made about his last season.
I've heard that. Yes.
That we might see in a couple of years. Has the family reached out to you and talked to you?
I spoke to one member of Kobe's extended family, John Cox, his cousin, who was very close to him, was almost like a little brother to him. I reached out to Joe and Pam. I wrote them a letter. I sent them a sample of my writing. I met Joe in the mid-90s when he was the assistant coach at LaSalle University, and I was a student at LaSalle. I was an undergrad at the time. So I wrote them a letter, sent them some of my stuff, and just said, look, I would love to speak to you and Sharia and Shea if you're willing to. I never heard back directly from them, but I heard through contacts that they knew I was doing the book and they were okay with me doing the book. I also tried to reach out to Vanessa Bryant, spoke to someone who was a publicist for her about a year or two ago, and same sort of thing. Vanessa's not going to stand in the way of you doing the book, but she's probably not going to speak to you. And that's fine because the book covers Kobe's life before he met Vanessa. So it's not like it was essential for me to speak to her. And there were other people from that time in Kobe's life who were able to fill in the gaps, who were really close to him. I talked to friends who were practically family members, people like that. So I feel pretty good about getting a level of intimacy with respect to the narrative. And I have these tapes and these transcripts of what Kobe was saying and thinking and feeling about his family and his teammates and all those things at that time. So that really helped a lot.
Did you talk to Brandy, his prom date?
I tried to. I contacted her mother. Never heard back. But there is a section in the book about Brandy and the prom. And Kobe speaks about that at length in the tapes and in the transcripts. So I was able to tell that story.
So obviously he went from Lower Merion to the pros, but there was always rumors that he's going to LaSalle. There was rumors that he was going to other Big Five schools. There was rumors also that he was going to go to Duke. And I think he might've kind of alluded that he was going to go to Duke. I don't know if because Krzyzewski was coaching him at the time and whatnot, Team USA. Do we find out what his college of choice would have been?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
You have to buy the book.
I like that. There you go. Not your first article book you've ever teased.
Nope.
Is there any story you could tell, maybe like your third or fourth favorite story?
There is. There's one that stands out to me that I really like because I think it gets to the heart of why Kobe's fascinating and what made him great. So Kobe had this friend named Anthony Gilbert, who has been a writer for Slam Magazine for a long time and got to know Kobe because Anthony was a student at Temple at the same time that Sharia Bryant, Kobe's one of Kobe's two older sisters, was a student there. So they became friends, and then he became friends with Kobe and the family through her. So Anthony was a couple years older than Kobe, but they were tight. And they would go around and play basketball together at playgrounds around the city, West Philly, North Philly, South Philly, even Ardmore, places like that. And Anthony had two jobs when he would play basketball with Kobe. One was to rebound for Kobe while Kobe worked on his three-point shooting and his footwork and his dunks and all this stuff. And the other thing was to shout at Kobe, try to distract him, try to rattle him. You go to a suburban school, you're soft. You go to a white school and aren't tough enough to play in the city. Like, he would yell these things at Kobe while Kobe was playing. And it was kind of this motivation to Kobe. And it was also this kind of, it was like he was putting on armor at an early stage of his life to prepare himself for the battles that were to come later. Like, these are the things he's going to hear playing in the Sunny Hill League, playing on the AAU circuit, playing against the kids from Chester, playing in the NBA. Like, hey, you know, you lived in Italy for 8 years. You came from Lower Merion Township where everybody's rich and drives fancy cars. You're not cut out to play ball the way a Philly kid can play ball. And he knew that he had to prepare himself. So every little advantage he could find, he took. And one of them was have his friend from West Philly in Temple scream at him all this time so that he could get into this mindset. And I think that little anecdote tells a lot about who Kobe was and why he was so tough mentally as an athlete.
I like that. Thank you. Thank you for sharing something. Sure. What do you want people to come away from this book when they're all said and done? They've read through all the pages. What would make Mike Cielski happy how they would come away from this book?
I hope people come away from it saying it was well written, that it was accurate, and that they got an idea. Now they understand better the part of Kobe's life that we feel like we're all familiar with, right? Like, I wanted to write this book in a way so that anybody who had a passing interest in Kobe or was familiar with him from his 20 years with the Lakers and the few years after, you know, he retired and before he died, they could say, oh, okay, like, now I know why that happened when he was an adult. And I'm talking about the good stuff, the bad stuff, the dark stuff, the controversial stuff, all of it. If you read this book, I hope you come away from it saying, okay, now I understand why that thing with Shaquille O'Neal happened. Mm. Or even to a degree, okay, now I see a connection to Aurora, Colorado in 2003 and 2004. That there are lines that you can draw, even subconsciously, to say, okay, now I understand better, you know, why he wanted to write children's books after his retirement. Why he became the father that he did after his retirement, how he was able to kind of change the narrative about his life after all those controversies and conflicts during his career. I hope that's all there.
Cool. It's when you're talking and I'm reading, like, and you sent me over two articles that are really good. Did you watch the Tiger Woods documentary on HBO?
I didn't.
Okay. It kind of felt like he didn't really have a childhood. That was more Earl related. Mm-hmm. Do you kind of feel like Kobe didn't have a childhood, but that was kind of on him? I don't know how much Joe pushed him, but it does feel like.
You're right, Kyle. He knew at an incredibly early age what he wanted to do. And his parents, he had an incredible family background. I mean, his loving father, loving mother, they indulged him when it came to basketball, but they disciplined him when it came to everything else. And the discipline that he brought to basketball in some ways came from within himself. He had seen what happened to his dad. Joe Bryant thought he got a raw deal from the NBA. He played 8 years there. He was kind of ahead of his time, a 6'9", 6'10" guy who could handle the ball. You know, in college and high school, they wanted to play him under the basket. He had a much more diverse array of skills than that. He could have played on the perimeter, created his own shot, very flashy player. But he didn't bring it every single day. And he talked about that a lot to Kobe and to people like I had to go to Italy to tap into the player I was always meant to be. And I think Kobe saw that and he wanted to redeem his father's good name in the sport. So he devoted himself to that, to being the very best all the time. And so, no, he didn't really have a normal childhood in the way you think about it, in part because he didn't want one. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had a girlfriend throughout most of his 4 years of high school. A customary date was her coming over on a Friday night to sit on the Bryant family couch and watch videotapes of Magic Johnson and Michael Jordan with Kobe. Does that sound like a normal date to you? Like it's not, but that's what Kobe wanted. And it led to him being the Kobe that we knew.
All right. Well, I can't get you out of here without asking about AV and the Flyers and everything. What's going on? Really, what I want to know is I'm a very casual. I'm a very pink hat Flyers fan. You talk to me in May, June. I'll be the biggest Flyers fan. I haven't watched the game yet. I just kind of want to know. I know I got Flyers fans that listen to this that are 4-for-4 guys. Is Drew gone this season?
It wouldn't surprise me. Just because I've been saying this for a while, this franchise needs a fresh, clean start, right? And I wrote a piece about this for the Inquirer today. It's on Inquirer.com now about you have to look at the Vigneault firing in the totality of the last like 15 to 17 years of this franchise. They have not drafted well for that period of time. They have not replenished the talent base in a way that they have needed to. And you can fire all the coaches you want. You can bring in Rick Tocchet or John Tortorella. The coach is not the issue. The issue is that if you can't draft players, and if you look back at their history, there are multiple years where they don't produce a productive NHL player out of anywhere from 6 to 11 picks in a year's draft. If you don't do that, you're going to end up where they've been, which is overpaying for already established players, trying to fill gaps otherwise, and having things maybe work for a short period of time and then fall apart quickly because you got to keep the cycle going. And that's their issue. Their talent pool has been shallow for too long. And it spans Ed Snyder's ownership into Dave Scott and Comcast ownership. It was the same. It was true with Paul Holmgren and Ron Hextall, and now with Chuck Fletcher. They just have not hit on enough draft picks to be good enough over the long term. And Hextall, to his credit, at least knew that it was going to take a long time. But the fact is now that they've missed on so many picks for so long that it's going to take probably at least as long for them to hit on as many picks to reverse this trend. So the idea that they're going to turn this around quickly, to me, it's a long shot that that's going to happen. I think, you know, they're going to be dealing with some mediocre years at best for a long time.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you coming on, even asking some Flyers and stuff. So
sure.
Go check out Mike's book, The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality, out January 11th. Where can people get it? Obviously, Amazon,
Barnes & Noble. They can go to theriseofkobebook.com, theriseofkobebook.com, and that'll take you to everywhere you can order the book, link you to the podcast. Please listen to the podcast. I think it's terrific. You'll hear Kobe in a way you've never heard him. That's what they can do.
Cool. And episode 5 for I Am Kobe, I think, just dropped.
Just dropped this morning.
Cool. So go listen to that and go listen to the first 4. Mike, thanks so much, man. Really appreciate you coming on and good luck with everything. No,
thanks for having me, Kyle. I enjoyed it.
That's the podcast. Rate, review, subscribe. Hope you enjoyed this one. Follow us on YouTube or subscribe to us on YouTube. Follow us on Twitter. Follow us on Instagram. Look at that video I just released with the Eagles-Jets tailgate. And we'll talk to you Friday.